Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this presentation of the IEA's latest energy technology perspectives. And we're really quite happy to have Neil Hurst and Michael Taylor with us this afternoon to be able to do this presentation. As introduction, I'm David Pumphrey. I'm Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Energy and National Security Program. We've been looking at this whole question about the role for technology and finding the pathway to a low-carbon energy future that both maintains a reasonable cost for energy while achieving levels of energy security that we'll need for our economy in the future. And I think this publication adds to that debate a tremendous amount of insight that we can all take away from it. Neil Hurst, I've known for many years. I guess maybe I shouldn't say how many, Neil, but Neil has been the director for the Energy Technology Division in the IEA for, is it 4 years now, Neil?
Just over three.
Just over three. 3 years. And before that was with the British Energy Department and had actually worked here in Washington in the British Embassy. Michael Taylor is a senior researcher with the Energy Technology Division. So without any further ado, I'll turn the floor over to Neil, and we'll have a presentation for probably about 30 minutes or so, and then after that, throw the floor open for questions. Neil?
Well, thank you very much, David, for that introduction. As you say, we go back quite a long time. We're very grateful to you and for the CSIS for laying this on, and we're delighted to be here in Washington. Let me start with some general, perhaps some general remarks about the messages, the origin and the messages of this publication, Energy Technology Perspectives 2008. The origin was really with the Glen Eagles Summit, G8 Summit in 2005, when one of the main topics was climate change, clean energy, and sustainable development. And the leaders specifically asked the IEA to provide scenarios and strategies for a more sustainable energy future, or specifically for a clean, clever, competitive energy future. And this book is a response to that request. Essentially, it shows how we can use energy technology to achieve really deep cuts in global CO2 emissions, and also in the medium and longer term to ease the pressures on energy markets. The book is based on extensive analytical and modeling work at the IEA, and also draws on the work of many experts, including US experts, who participate in our international energy technology network. In Energy Technology Perspectives, we examine what it would take to bring CO2 emissions back to their current levels in 2050. But we also examine, for the first time, what would be required for the world to halve the level of current emissions in the same period. So we look at back to the present level and half the present level in 2050. And as many of you will be familiar, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said, in effect, that we need cuts at least that deep, at least as deep as 50% below current levels, if we are to contain global warming within the range of 2 to 3 degrees centigrade. And there are some important headline messages from this book. To bring CO2 emissions back to current levels in 2050, we need all technology options available up to a cost of $50 per ton of CO2. For this, we need to achieve very large improvements in efficiency across all sectors of the energy economy, and we need to substantially decarbonize power generation. But those changes, if you go with the requirements of the IGCC, are not sufficient. And if we are to halve the level of CO2 emissions, we will need all options up to a cost of $200 per ton of CO2 saved. Even this is based, in our view, on fairly optimistic assumptions about the rate at which technology will advance. And under less optimistic assumptions, the marginal cost could be as high as $500 per ton of CO2. We have estimated the total incremental investment, that's to say additional investment in the energy sector above our base case, at $45 trillion between now and 2050. That is just over 1%. That is an average of just over 1% of global GDP in that period. Now, there's no doubt at all that meeting such a target, 50% cut in emissions, represents a formidable challenge. The G8, some of you recall, have said that they wish to seriously consider this target. Some members of the G8 are committed to such a target. Would require immediate policy action and technology transition on an unprecedented scale. It essentially requires a new global energy revolution, which would transform the way that we produce and the way that we use energy. If we could achieve such a change, the energy security benefits would be tremendous. In this case, the 50% reduction case, which you will soon learn we refer to as the blue case in our scenario, the blue case, oil demand in 2050 is actually 27% below the current level. First time we've ever produced a scenario where we envisage reduction in global oil demand. So this scenario calls for immediate action. And one of the most important features of the book is that we provide what, in all honesty, I must describe as a first attempt at technology roadmaps, global technology roadmaps, spelling out what we think will need to be done in order to deliver the potential of the most important energy technologies in our study. And those of you who've been following the ministerial meetings, the G8 plus India, China, and Korea in Aomori, Japan, a week or so ago, will know that there the ministers launched a project to develop these roadmaps further and try to achieve international, global consensus on where these technologies are going and how these changes can actually be achieved. Now, that's my very general introduction to this study. Let me go through some more detailed slides of the analysis. Ah, I read this move. I might press the wrong one. Oh, I'll do it better off with this one. Left click. Okay. Here we go. That's just who we are, in case any of you don't know. Not to be confused with the IAEA, which does nuclear non-proliferation work, or what is it, the IEA, which is the US thing. We are the I got it. Okay. We are the International Energy Agency. We're based in Paris. We are a part of the OECD family. You'll see the flanks of the countries that are around our thing are sort of philosophy, three goals, which are evident throughout this: energy security, environmental protection, economic growth, and there's a list of something. Some of you will know us for the World Energy Outlook, a flagship publication of the IEA. We also have a very, very major role into the strategic oil stocks of OECD countries. So that's who we are. I won't dwell on that. It's interesting to see how many of these are the leaders at Gleneagles. Not all of them still in place. But I've said that already. And here's a little bit about the study. It's a study about the role of technology, and it has roadmaps. It's not really, we've tried to avoid, because it's very sensitive, getting into anything that would directly impact on national Kyoto-type targets. And we don't really, I mean, our expertise in energy technology, I must emphasize that. We are not experts on climatology. We're not experts on agriculture or forestry. We have just, and we're not really experts either on the sort of politics of climate instruments. This is not a study about Kyoto mechanisms or the Bali process. So here are the scenarios we have. We go to 2050, and our reference scenario, business as usual case, is based originally on our World Energy Outlook business as usual case. That goes to 2030. We've extended that. And then we have two main, strictly speaking, they are sets of scenarios, although in each case, the sort of core scenario we call the MAP, so ACT MAP and Blue MAP. ACT is getting back to current levels of CO2 emissions by 2050. Blue is a 50% reduction. And then there is sections in the book on how we get there, including some of the key sectors and roadmaps. And there's a sector on the costs. So here we have, probably this is our most, our sort of core summary chart. The upper boundary line of the colored thing is the pathway of baseline emissions. So they're rising from the current level of something like 27 gigatons of CO2. Everything is in CO2, in case you're used to carbon emissions. CO2 today to 62 gigatons. And that rise is actually steeper than when we last forecast it because economic growth is a bit more buoyant, particularly in the big developing countries, but especially because we are seeing a switch towards coal. Not only coal in power stations, but also coal for coal to liquids. And these, in the absence of carbon capture and storage, are very carbon-intensive sources of energy. So that's the top line. The bottom line is where we need to get to in terms of carbon emissions in 2050, 14 gigatons, if we go to halve the current level. And you will see, for instance, that the savings that we need to make against baseline in 2050 are actually greater than total emissions today. So sometimes, you know, presenting these charts, you can fall into the habit of saying, oh, well, this is the way we're going. It's not at all the way we're going. It's a fantastic task to make this change. And then the colored elements show where we think the savings could be achieved. And what you see there is energy efficiency is the most important area. Energy efficiency across the board, transport, buildings, appliances, industry, 36% of all the savings in this period are energy efficiency. The next biggest element is carbon capture and storage. For power generation, but also in the blue case for industry, for obviously only the biggest, most emitting industries, and then renewables play a huge role, 21%, and nuclear power are an important element of this. Nuclear power is slightly underrepresented in this because these are the incremental savings, and in fact there's quite a lot of nuclear in the reference case, in the reference case itself. This is the same chart, broken down not by, broken but down by main sector of the economy. I won't dwell on that except just to note, you know, very big savings have to be found in the power sector, transport, industry and buildings, in that order, but they must all make big contributions. In this chart, we try to make the real implications for the power sector a bit more meaningful. And what it shows is, now I'm sure I've got the colours. I always have trouble making sure I'm describing the colours. But the dark red area to the left-hand side of each of those. Of those lines is the current rate of investment. So you can see, for instance, that with hydro, basically we would need to continue with the current rate of investment, just a bit more, sustaining the current rate of investment. But if you look at the top at coal-fired power stations with CCS, we really haven't started building those yet, so there's a huge increase needed. By the way, the dark blue is the ACT case, getting back to current levels. The light blue is the increment needed to get to the blue case, 50% below current levels. Nuclear is different because obviously nuclear build in recent years has been very low. So we illustrate in the green section what we call the historic high. I think it's over 10 years, the highest sustained level of nuclear build in the past. And you can see that we probably need to increase that by about a third. You can just look at those. I won't go down them all, but the full extent of those lines shows the investment in gigawatts per annum that needs to be made in clean electric power capacity on average every year between now and 2050 to get to the blue case. And you can form, you know, we're certainly not saying that's easy. Is that possible? 32 nuclear plants every year, 35 CCS coal-fired plants. These are not alternatives. You have to do all of those together to achieve the desired result. This is probably the other most illuminating single figure that's in our study. It shows it's a curve of the marginal costs of CO2 abatement technologies as you increase the amount of the CO2 emissions that you need to save. So you look on the x-axis, you see gigatons of global gigatons of CO2 per annum that need to be saved. And so, for instance, to get back to current levels of CO2 emissions, the ACT case, you need to save 35 gigatons per annum. And to get to the blue case, the 50% reduction, I'm doing this by inspection, you need to save, it looks like 47 gigatons. And on the y-axis, we have the marginal cost in terms of US dollars per ton, again, of CO2 saved. And the story, this is simplified. You can criticize this chart because it's quite simplified. but the basic message is the low-cost options are mainly around energy efficiency, and arguably there's a lot you can done. You can save something like 15 gigatons with actions which actually pay for themselves. They don't have any extra cost. The reasons they're not happening are to do with various kinds of inertia and institutional factors, but cost isn't the issue. Then you get into the question of low-carbon power generation. These are the options, you know, nuclear power, carbon capture and storage, renewables that I've talked about, and on a fairly optimistic basis, the blue is the range of uncertainty. So the fairly optimistic basis is the bottom of that curve. On a fairly optimistic basis, you can largely decarbonize the power sector at a cost of around $50 per ton of CO2 saved. But beyond that, trying to get to absolute reductions in global emissions, the costs start to rise fairly steeply. And here you're into applying carbon capture and storage to the most emitting large industrial plant. And then you're into transport. And let me say just a little bit about transport. Of course, as with everything else, the biggest savings in transport for energy efficiency. We think the technologies exist to approximately double the fuel efficiency of conventional vehicles with internal combustion engines. That's all in the end-use efficiency. But to get beyond that, you're into the alternative technologies. Electric vehicles, hydrogen vehicles, and to some extent, biofuels. In this study, we acknowledge there's a lot of uncertainty about these technologies. A lot more research and development is needed. We don't really know the true costs, and we don't really know which will be the most successful technology. So we have a range of scenarios. But we think it's reasonable to believe that alternative transport fuels are going to be a lot more costly per ton of CO2 saved. And you can see there we have the cost rising, even on the optimistic case, to $200 per ton of CO2 saved, and a much wider range of uncertainty in the blue. This slide shows what happens to the demand for, well, conventional fuels, but also nuclear, biomass, and renewables. One of the things it illustrates is the really spectacular rise in demand for coal that we see in the business as usual case. But perhaps I should explain. For each fuel, if you start from the left, you have a column which shows, first of all, the actual position in 2005, then a slight gap. Then you have the baseline projection. Then you have the ACT projection, and you have the blue projection. So with coal, you see spectacular increase in demand in the baseline case. In the other cases, coal demand is still very, very substantial, but slightly below current levels. But the one I particularly want to draw your attention to is the oil case. We see substantial increase in oil demand 2050 in the baseline case. Now, of course, there's a tremendous amount of debate around whether those volumes of oil could actually be made available. I don't think we necessarily know the answer to that, but that's where the trends could take you. But as I said before, for the first time, we now see in the blue case, if that could be achieved, an actual reduction in global oil demand. I'm not going to dwell on the other things, the ones right now. Well, there's a broad outline of some of the key trends. I'm now going to turn over to Michael, who's a senior analyst working on this this project. He's going to talk to you a bit about the technology pathways and a bit more detail of some of the particular technology areas.
All right, thank you, Neil and David. So as Neil mentioned, what I'm going to talk to you very quickly about is some of the technology transitions that are required and also go into a little more detail about the individual sectors. So what you've seen up to now is an introduction to where we are in 2050 with our ACT scenarios and our blue scenarios. So we have our, you know, a slightly more or a dramatically more sustainable energy system in 2050 in these scenarios, but how do we get there? What are the pathways that we need to hit? What windows do we need to achieve in order to ensure that this transition takes place? Because it's going to require a lot of technology deployment. In the blue scenario, we're relying on technologies which are not yet proven. In some cases, they're only really at the R&D stage. So how do we get there? One of the key components of this is that we've looked for the first time at technology roadmaps within the framework of these scenarios. So informed by the scenario results, we've looked at 17 roadmaps for key technologies, or in many cases, these are really more correctly groupings of technologies, on the demand and the supply side. In total, these 17 roadmaps cover around 90%, 87% of the total savings in the blue map scenario. So we're covering here, in the major part, all of the results. You can see here on the supply side, big focus on the power generation sector, which we're looking to substantially decarbonize or virtually decarbonize in the blue scenario, but also second generation biofuels. On the demand side, obviously we're moving into the realm of energy efficiency. What are the key technologies? Building shells, heat pumps, solar, space and water heating, etc. So this is really a first attempt, and we have limited space within this publication. So this is an opening opportunity to put into the public arena what we think needs to happen to make these scenarios work. This is an example of the roadmaps for CCS. I should mention here, Neil mentioned that the G8 ministers have picked up on the roadmaps idea, but they've also picked up on our recommendations for CCS. They've come out and said that they're committed to bringing 10 CCS demonstration plants, well, committed to putting in process 10 CCS full-scale plants by 2010. And this is the roadmap for CCS in which we look at. On the top left, you can see here the pie charts show the distribution of the deployment of this technology in 2050, the contribution it makes to the total savings. Under that, we have what the deployment shares look like by region, where the R&D cost and deployment costs are, the commercial investment. Under that, we look briefly at the technology targets that you'll need in terms of R&D and also deployment. And then also on the top right-hand side, you have a very colourful chart here. This was coined the sunglasses chart because you need a sunglasses to look at it properly without being blinded by the colours. It's a toned down a bit. But we're looking at seeing what's the transition in terms of technology deployment in the baseline ACT and blue scenarios. We're also making some broad outlines in terms of the key actions needed and the key areas of international collaboration. And as Neil mentioned, we're hoping that the IEA is going to play a major role in coordinating this work in coming years. What do the scenarios... Another question that we need to ask with the scenarios is, are there any obstacles in terms of the financing needs in these scenarios? We need to look at what's required in terms of R&D investment, deployment investment, so that we get technology learning scaling up that helps bring down the cost of these technologies so we can reduce the cost of CO2 emissions reduction. And finally, there's the overall total commercial investment cost. We've estimated, as Neil mentioned, that the total investment cost is US $45 trillion over this period for the blue scenario, $17 trillion for ACT, 1.1% of cumulative GDP, or in the case of ACT, it's 0.4%. So very significant numbers, most of the investment comes from the demand side, around 80%. We're talking about investment here by consumers in more efficient light-duty vehicles, more efficient appliances, additional insulation in their homes, etc. If undiscounted, the fuel savings from these investments actually outweigh the upfront investments, but of course that's not very realistic. If you discount, say, at 10%, then there is a net marginal investment requirement of around $7 trillion for the blue scenario. So perhaps the problem can best be described for blue as not the overall cost. We think it's within the realms of possibility. But there's a question of how we value the savings of the fuel. We've evaluated at market prices. If you're looking at a more social aspect, you could say that part of this is actually producer surplus and you're actually reallocating this. So there's some issues going on, but we think the major problem perhaps is the burden sharing issues. 60% of these investment needs will have to happen in non-OECD countries. If this is not going to be a barrier to the uptake, they're going to need some help with this. In terms of summarising quite quickly, the financing needs are perhaps $2 to $3 trillion for R&D, $7 trillion for deployment and learning, and then the balance obviously gets you up to $45 trillion total. What we've seen, this is a graph of the public sector energy R&D. Now, we attempted to look at how we might quantify the R&D needs. We think this is very difficult, and we're not sure that it's actually adds much to the debate trying to quantify it, given the links, difficulty of identifying the links. But one thing is clear. You can see here that public sector R&D halved since its peak in the early 1980s. So the trend is definitely not matching the political rhetoric. It's clear that we need a significant increase in the R&D investment, and this could be in the range of perhaps $10 to $100 billion additional dollars per year. In terms of emissions, moving on now to the sectoral results, looking at the emissions reductions by sector, starting with industry, overall you can see that in the first two columns there's a significant reduction in below the baseline scenario in 2050 in both the ACT and Blue Map scenarios. But we have such significant growth in the demand for some of these industrial products that in the ACT Map scenario, you can see in the third column across, that in fact we still have energy demand emissions growing up in these sectors. It's only when we shift to the more stringent goal of Blue Map that you see that most of the sectors turn negative. And that overall the total reduces by about one-fifth. Going back to power generation, Neil's mentioned already how important it is the use of renewables, nuclear generation, and CCS. This graph you can see electricity generation from at a global level, and the first three bars on the left-hand side you see the baseline scenario. Very strong growth in electricity demand, particularly from developing countries as they become richer, and a dramatic increase in coal share. So the carbon intensity of the electricity generation sector in the baseline scenario, in the absence of new policies, is getting more carbon intensive. We're going in the wrong direction. In ACT MAP, total generation requirements are reduced. We have an energy efficiency component, and we also see a dramatic reduction in the use of coal-fired generation without CCS. Renewables play an important role, and nuclear as well. In Blue Map, generation increases slightly. We have more energy efficiency, but because we're substantially decarbonising the electricity generation sector in the scenario, we can use electrification as an efficient abatement option. So we have slightly more demand in this scenario. But renewables contribute 46% of total generation. Nuclear, another 23%, virtually decarbonising the energy, the power generation sector by 2050. Here you can see where this reduction in the Blue Map scenario, this effective decarbonisation of the power generation sector, where it's attributed to. big chunk is CO2 capture and storage. We see this as a vital technology for those countries with large indigenous coal resources that they're likely to exploit at low cost. Important contributions from wind and the other renewables, particularly solar. We're quite optimistic for solar beyond 2030 with sufficient deployment. Important contribution from nuclear, and then some efficiency options and fuel switching in fossil fuel generation. In terms of the transportation sector, this is the, as Neil has already alluded to in the marginal cost graph, we think this is going to be the toughest nut to crack in terms of really achieving the blue scenario at reasonable cost. There's lots you can do with energy efficiency that's negative cost or low cost. There are technologies for the internal combustion engine, lightweighting, more efficient onboard appliances. But going further, we're going to have to look at not only efficiency, but CO2-free options. If we're going to have a more than threefold global increase in light-duty vehicle travel, you need to do more than a little bit with efficiency. But it's not clear to us if we can achieve that at a reasonable cost, and what is the successful technology. We think electrification and hydrogen fuel cells are potential with significant investment and deployment, but it's not clear to us which will be the most successful technology, indeed whether they are competing technologies or whether they're complementary. So we have a number of scenarios to explore the results. In the blue map, you can see the significant contribution from fuel cells and electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids. We then have a blue conservative where hydrogen fuel cells and electric vehicles are simply too expensive, and we hybridize as much as we can to reduce the energy consumption and CO2 footprint of the transport sector. Then we have a blue fuel cell success or electric vehicle success. So we have a range of scenarios to try and explore the results that might occur in this sector. In terms of the importance, this is similar to what we see at a global level for the overall energy economy. Fuel efficiency is primary, and then the other half of the pie is essentially coming from alternatives with a low or zero CO2 footprint. Biofuels have to be second generation if they're going to be deployed on a large enough scale to make a significant difference. This is an elaboration of the total primary energy supply graph that Neil presented. On the left-hand side, the three bars, you can see the growth in the oil supply in the baseline scenario. You can see that the red and green lines, this is the conventional oil, start to reduce their share. We're seeing an increase in the contribution from more carbon-intensive unconventional oil sources, shale oil, oil sands, but also Arctic and perhaps ultra-deep as well. In ACT-MAP, we come down significantly because of the use of energy efficiency and biofuels, but we're still above today's level. In blue map, we're 27% below. As I mentioned, if we have our conservative scenario, we come back quite a bit further. We don't have the same low cost or, well, same opportunities at the $200 a tonne CO2 abatement option, so it's only an 11% reduction. If we have blue fuel cell or EV success, the results are more or less the same, but that's more or less because of the way the scenarios are designed. Here you can see what biofuels are making the contribution in the transport sector. Here you can see that by 2050, biodiesel dominates. This is the nature of the stringency of the challenge in the blue scenario. In ACT-MAP, we could use biofuels in the light-duty vehicle fleet, and we more or less ignored air transport and shipping. But blue, because we not only have to act on the light-duty vehicle fleet, we have to not only stop the growth in CO2 emissions from air transport, we have to try and push that negative. We see that the highest value use for that bioenergy feedstock is going to be going into biodiesel. So that's an important policy conclusion. In terms of the costs, I'll skip over this quite quickly. This is LDV technology costs, cost abatement. As Neil mentioned, we think transportation, particularly the cost of fuel cell vehicles or electric vehicles, is going to be setting the marginal cost in the blue scenario. But it just also to highlight to the left-hand side the negative options as well for short-term energy efficiency gains. So, to wrap up quickly for some key messages, we have a 644-page book, 17 chapters, 1.83 kilos. We tried to be brief, but it's a very complex topic. But to sum up, we'll try and achieve that. So what we can say is we're facing a very urgent challenge in the energy sector. And this is not only a climate challenge, this is an energy security challenge, it's an affordability challenge. It's the three E's of the IEA. It's clear to us that technology solutions are the key, but it needs to be a global solution. Emission stabilisation, we can see this in the ACT-MAP scenario. We can do this mostly with energy efficiency and the power generation sector. That's a simplification, but it's a clear message. Halving the emissions by 2050 implies deep cuts as well for transport and industry. And this, when we look at the technologies available to do this, they're not here today. We need to invest in R&D, deployment, and we're not sure how much it's going to cost. Potentially, it's going to be very significant. As we said, marginal cost of up to $50 a tonne for ACT and up to $200 a tonne for blue. But even that's potentially optimistic assessment. The cost uncertainty increases critically with the ambition, a very important point. The additional investment needs are significant in terms of percentage of GDP. It's not so large, but what they do show is a clear challenge for policymakers to ensure that they're not a barrier to the rapid uptake of these technologies and energy efficiency. And this is particularly true because of the importance of consumer investment in energy efficiency. There are very important security of supply benefits, particularly in the oil sector, with a 27% reduction below 2005 levels, but also in terms of reduced gas demand. We're not below today's level, but it's significantly reduced compared to the baseline. We need a step change in government policies, and it's critical that we achieve closer international cooperation in the short term, or get agreement in the short term for closer international collaboration and cooperation. We've hoped with the analysis on the transition from today to these more sustainable energy future scenarios that these roadmaps, this technology transition, can provide a focus for some of this international collaboration, and the IEA can help contribute to the solution. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Neil and Michael. It's a great summary of an extensive piece of work. And just to reiterate, I did have a copy of their as small as possible book, and it is quite heavy. So it's a lot of material in there. We have a couple of ground rules we like to follow in terms of asking questions. One, that you identify yourself and the organization that you're with, and that to the extent possible you turn whatever statement you have into a question, even if it's at the end of adding a question mark so that we can have it be a Q&A session. But comments are certainly welcome, but they should end up as a question. So we'll go ahead and get started in the back, please.
John Tree, Executive Chairman of Sea Life Technology. I realize you're focusing on technology, but to what extent is the possibility, the value, if you will, or the magnitude of biological offsets factored into your study? I didn't hear any mention of it.
Sorry, you mean land use change and forestry?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This study was only the energy sector CO2 emissions. We don't have expertise really in the areas that you're discussing. We did for the first time look at methane, but again only from the energy sector. So this is really not an area that we can look at. Our colleagues in other international organisations obviously do that. There's a lot of international literature about what we say is that, I mean, we're providing a technology vision of how the energy sector can contribute to a 450 parts per million scenario. Then it appears that the rest of the if you like, the components can get there as well, but that's not really our area of expertise.
Jonathan Elkind, Eastlink Consulting and Brookings Institution. I had two questions. Could you please comment on one of the discussions, one of the ideas that is kicked around in Washington quite frequently? That idea is that one can safely delay a response, particularly in the energy sector, on the presumption that later one will have more better technology. Does your study reflect on that one way or the other? Second question, to your roadmaps, just if I could ask for a little bit of clarification. For example, with the CCS roadmap that you put up, am I correct that you are... How is it that you are deriving? Could you just describe again how you are deriving that roadmap? How is it that you come back to the presumption, for example, that under blue you need this breakthrough by this kind of a time window? Thank you.
Well, on your first question, I think we would strongly discourage anyone to take comfort in the thought that, you know, you can delay and wait for a miracles could always happen, but generally speaking, it must be said that technology takes a long time to get from what may appear to be thrilling breakthroughs on the on the bench in a laboratory to technologies that actually make a difference on the scale that you need. For this kind of change. So, and furthermore, there are a lot of reasons for thinking that action is very urgent. For instance, the fact that the US and actually most other countries, certainly in Europe, are going to have to renew a large part of their power generation stock, combined with the fact that we know there's going to be huge investment in power generation in India and China over the next decade. So if you wait for all that to be built, a lot of it with coal power stations, frankly, you've missed the boat if you're going to aim for these very deep cuts that we're talking about. So I think our strong message is, you know, action on these topics is urgent and should not be late. How the roadmaps have been derived? Well, they basically... are derived, backwards from the outcome of our analysis. Our analysis is a least cost analysis. Some of you may be aware of that. It's called a Markle model, deep technology model. That gives you the kind of deployment you're looking for over this period, and then you work back from that, and you see, well, what actually needs to be in place when. And it's that kind of pattern that gives you, for instance, the commitment. And actually, it's 20 for 20 demonstration CCS plants to be committed by 2010. Because if you don't do that, you will miss the opportunity, probably, to have really commercial CCS plant in place in time for at least some of the boom of power generation that we're expecting in the next 20 years. So I don't know if that's an adequate explanation of how we work that. That's my help.
Thank you. I'm Leonard Oberlander, a consultant. Given the scenarios and the strategies you've presented for with regard to CO2 emissions reduction, if the patterns emerge that you are hypothesizing or forecasting, a quick analysis in my mind raises this question. Since the aircraft require liquid fuel, either carbon or biofuel, which is more expensive, in a future scenario where oil field development and production and refinement become economically too expensive or prohibitive for fueling the aviation industry, what is the likelihood of the future for an air transport system? And I know this addresses ground-based, you know, factories, plants, automobiles, but what about the aviation system where you have only liquid fuel and no alternative?
Well, that is really the story of that chart. Maybe we should... Can we get back to the chart that we... on biodiesel? Because one of the things that happens when you move from the ACT case to the blue case, the ACT case, get back to current levels, perhaps without doing anything very radical to air transport. But to get to the blue case, as you are implying, you do need to do something quite radical. And in that case, it turns out that the highest value, the premium use for biofuels and for the stock of biomaterials that you have, which is limited, is in transport other than light vehicles, and particularly in aviation. And that is why, in this chart, we see biodiesel, which essentially is the biofuel that has substitutability for aviation fuel, as being really quite dominant. So that's the story that we see.
Let me go over to this side here if there's some questions on this side here in front.
Yeah, actually, my question is a follow-up to the previous one in your answer. But in that respect, the contribution of the blue section appears to be a lot larger than the other cases. And if that were the case, then initially when you showed a chart on the overall emission contributions, you only considered carbon dioxide emissions. The airline emissions they say that the airline emissions contribute only 2% of the global warming from CO2, but the overall effect could be as much as 20 much higher than 2%. Would this change the previous charts as well then? If you were to include the airline emissions and their contribution to global warming?
This our analysis is only based on the CO2. We did discuss briefly the uncertainty surrounding the total contribution of aviation to CO2 emissions, to global warming, to radiative forcing. But it's not an area we've analysed in any depth. Potentially, if you take into account the implications of the other pollutants in the upper atmosphere, water vapour, etc., it could have an impact on the least costs solution for the aviation industry. But we haven't looked at it in any detail. This is purely focusing on the contribution of the fuel consumption of CO2.
Good. A question in the back there, and then on the side here.
Joe Masita, Gibbs Energy. I have two questions. As you look at all of the CCS that you're talking about implementing, did you analyze the availability of labor and materials? Because it's quite, right now, with current technology, is extremely low temperature and very steel intensive. And in all of your technology development scenarios, is anyone actually looking at reusing any of this carbon as opposed to just throwing it away, which is just a cost?
I'll make a couple of comments, and Michael may want to. I think the answer is that we haven't looked in depth to the materials requirement of this. And, in fact, it's something that we want to turn to. It's something that one of the things we did was we presented this study to a group of chief technology officers from really most of the big energy and engineering companies you can think of. And that's one of the things they said to us. Have you looked at how much steel you need and so on? And I think that it's fair to say, that we haven't looked in depth at the material side of this, and we would like to do a lot more of that. Making use of the CO2, yes, of course, there is... of course, the best-known use of CO2 is for tertiary oil recovery, and we have had a look at that.
However, I think it is clear that the scale, relatively speaking, relative to the huge scale of CO2 storage required by these scenarios, the opportunities for enhanced oil and gas recovery are probably fairly described as niche situations. It's not, you're not going to get most of this. Now, I don't know whether Michael knows any. I mean, people have come up with some ideas about, you know, could you use CO2 for various purposes. I'm not aware that any of them at the moment, you know, are, well, it's certainly not demonstrated as providing a, you know, economically valid use for anything like the scale of CO2 that we're talking about. Is there anything more to say?
Yeah, well, I don't have a comment on that, but your first question in terms of the CCS, the costs in terms of materials and so on, one of the conclusions when we've gone from 2006 to now is that CCS is more expensive than we thought it was 2 years ago. And part of the reason for that is that, well, all major engineering projects are more expensive. Part of that's a labour issue, but a lot of it's been driven by increased commodity costs, steel being particularly one of those. What we're going to do, as Neil mentioned, as a result of the feedback from the chief technology officers, is in one of our forthcoming publications, we're going to look in an integrated way at are our scenarios internally consistent? Is our expansion of CCS, nuclear, hydro, et cetera, consistent with the steel consumption that we have in our model? So are we internally consistent? So we're looking for voluntary contributions, actually, to get that project underway.
A little advertising as well.
Scott Hassel with the RAND Corporation. I had a question about the roadmaps that you had proposed. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on what those would be, the types of international cooperation you envision. You'd also mentioned increasing R&D, but I'd just like to hear you explain kind of what those roadmaps would be and how you think they would end up making an impact. Thank you.
Well, this is a subject that was discussed at ministers at Amory, and I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's worth looking at their conclusions on that, where they describe fairly specifically a project they are launching. This is the G8 plus India, China, and Korea, albeit it starts with the expression, those of us interested. So they're not all necessarily at this moment, but they did collectively launch this. Yeah, our idea is this, that of course there are big programs around the world to take most of these technologies forward. Undoubtedly the biggest are those in the United States, in Europe, and in Japan, but some other countries are big players in some individual technologies. And the concept here is that we would do an exercise of sort of comparing what is happening. Most of these R&D programs have their own roadmaps. They may not sometimes call that specifically, sometimes not. Comparing these R&D programs, what their objectives are, what their roadmaps are, and trying to produce a global picture of where those projects together are taking us. We would do this through our senior technology committee at the IEA, but involving India and China as well, and with engagement by industry, possibly through the chief technology officers that we already have engaged with this. And the idea is to produce some messengers for ministers. Do we have a coherent program? Are we doing enough in these areas? Do the programs fit together well enough? A very good and very topical example is the various projects around the world for developing carbon capture and storage. Do those? We've said we need 20 projects. The reason we've said we need 20 is because there are different technologies, there are different coal qualities, and you probably need to demonstrate in certain parts of the world. You know, do what the governments are doing actually fit together and give you that kind of program? So that's the kind of approach that we want to develop. And I guess the essence of it is to give governments collectively some ability to review what is happening around the world and take a view of what needs to be done. I think that's the idea.
Neil, you might want to. I'm not sure if others are having the same problem. I know I'm having trouble reading this chart that was posted there, and I don't know if Right, and I don't know if you want to maybe highlight just a few items in the different categories that might give a little texture to what the roadmap would contain. I mean, just sort of perhaps read them off so that I don't know if that would be helpful for us.
Okay. I mean, the important thing to say here is that we had two pages for each roadmap here. So it's really to give you a flavor of what a roadmap would look like for the scenario results we have. Obviously, the program that we have envisaged for the future is a much more in-depth analysis. But here you have quite simply on the top the pie chart is simply the shares of deployment that we see in 2050 in each scenario by region. Then you have where the R&D might be distributed by region, where the investment's coming from. Under that, we have the technology targets here. So a very simple representation of what are the goals and perhaps key obstacles that we need to overcome. Under that, still on the left-hand side here, you have the deployment side of the technology targets. On the top right-hand side, this is a very simple look at what is the transition from where we are today with the technology to its endpoint in 2050 under each of the three scenarios, so baseline, ACT, and blue. And here we have little tidbits in terms of windows that have to be hit in terms of deployment, you know, 200 gigawatts and so on. And also the colours are meant to represent at which stage in the technology cycle they're in. So blue is RD&D, the orange is demonstration, yellow is deployment, and green here is commercialization. Obviously, this is pretty high level. Under that, key points of key actions required. These vary obviously by technology. Under that, key areas of international collaboration. So this is basically looking for us to find a niche. So I hope that's helpful. Really, I mean, this is as Neil has mentioned, this is a process that's going to be quite involved and we're hoping to move forward. But the idea is that it's going to be a consensus-based approach. We're not going to sit in our ivory tower in Paris and come up with something. It's meant to be in people engaged.
Yeah, I should just add very briefly. I mean, this is sort of the IEA's core business because you may not be familiar with this, but one of the major sort of roles of the IEA is that we sort of preside over this very large international network of more than 40 technology agreements focusing on all these. There's a major agreement called the Greenhouse Gas Agreement, which is specifically about carbon capture and storage. All the big players are there, India, China, and so on. So sort of this kind of thing is sort of what we do. Yeah.
Yes. Andrew Dowdy, U.S. State Department. I'm somewhat curious. I think in the latest BP statistical review shows a very high growth rate for things like wind. I forgot the number, 32% per year, I believe. Yet I note, if I recall correctly, in your blue scenario, you have about a 12% for wind in 2050. Is that limited? Is that market penetration limited by the intermittency factor of wind and some of the renewables? And if so, what is the potential for electricity storage technology, which also links to some of the electric vehicles, the vehicle-to-grid sorts of scenarios? To what extent have you looked at that? Does that have a real potential? Thank you.
It's a very good question, in fact. The 12% there was the share of the savings in the power generation sector. Curiously, that's also, I think, the final It's not the final share. The share of wind and power generation is higher than that in 2050. In ETP 2006, we did limit the penetration of wind. This time, for blue, we didn't. What we did was we went to our technology network and said, what do we need to do to make it happen? And so, in fact, what we have here is actually a more expensive electricity transmission and distribution system. We're not only connecting more remote renewables to the grid, so we've got more transmission distance, we're having to reinforce the grid to allow for the intermittency. Of course, the greater the penetration, you do get some benefits in the increasing geographical dispersion of the sites will give you some counterbalancing savings. But that's not to say that they'll be important strengthening requirements of the grid. The other side is that we need a smart grid on the demand side as well. To minimize the cost of this, the additional cost for the system, we need to work on the demand side as well. That's also particularly important because it's difficult to decarbonize peak generation, peak electricity generation. So that's slightly off topic.
Will Cole, Johns Hopkins University. I'm curious if you could say something a little more about how you make projections for nuclear power, given that you have some member countries that have made commitments to nuclear, some have nuclear on hold, some have no nuclear power. How does that work?
Okay. A very difficult subject with our member countries, as you can imagine. Our wording is that nuclear power will be used where it's acceptable and least cost. What this effectively means is that at a country level, there's going to be quite a lot of variation in terms of how it's taken up. Originally, we constrained total capacity to around 1,200 gigawatts, and that was as a basis of feedback from our CTO meeting, where with discussions around the need, constraints on fuel supply, in fact, uranium. However, there are varying opinions on this, so we've done a high nuclear scenario as well, where the total limit is 2,000 gigawatts. So it's a very political area of discussion. But in many countries, I mean, it will be a least cost option.
One thing the analysis shows is that there is quite a measure of choice for individual countries. You definitely need to decarbonize your power generation, but the balance between renewables, nuclear, and CCS, different countries can take different approaches to that. And
take some questions from the left side here, on the edge there, and then followed by. Sorry, John.
Oh, Christine Kortner with Platt Submissions Daily. I had a question to go back to that $50 U.S. per ton for carbon. Specifically in the report, I wanted to see if you factored in the formation of a U.S. carbon market and when, if you did. And then also if you factored in international carbon markets in the sense of the U.S. Doing its own thing or possibly being part of a broader scheme. In other words, to bring that $50 up or down or to a level that will encourage technology investment?
The answer to that is no. This isn't really a study about mechanisms of that. It's really simply a technology study that tries to bottom what the incremental costs are. As your question implies, there are lots of different ways in which those costs, that you might create the incentives necessary for those costs to be borne by investors. But the answer is no, the study doesn't go into different things.
Kyle Gracie with SustainUs. I had a question, going back to the earlier question about inaction. Have you attempted to include overall cost estimates for inaction compared to, I saw you had estimates of the Blue and ACT cost scenarios, but related to damaged ecosystem services or extreme weather events, have you included comparisons for overall costs of doing nothing?
I think the answer is no. We don't have a specific case trying to cost out the cost of delay, but I would just highlight sort of what happened last time, because we did this before, published in 2006, and since then we've had to double our estimate of the marginal cost of CO2 abatement measures that you now need to get back to the same case we did last time, let's say, back to current levels. It's probably wrong to characterize those simply as sort of costs of delay, because some of those are the extra costs from the rising costs, which Michael has referred to, of major engineering plant. But some of it is the fact that, while there hasn't been the kind of radical action we're calling for by governments, the fact is that estimates of carbon emissions have risen since then. It does make it more difficult now to get back to.
So just to to reiterate, we haven't actually looked at, if you like, the benefits of action. So if you flip that around, it's the cost of delay. What we did do, though, is we constrained the model to a 15-year planning horizon. Normally, it has perfect foresight. So this is to imply that everybody is sure of what the goal is, what the policies are, so you have certainty to make your investment decisions around a long-term constraint, which is CO2 emissions. But if we change that to a 15-year time horizon to mimic, if you like, uncertainty about what politicians are going to come up with, then the marginal cost increased by about 20%. So there is, you know, there is a cost to uncertainty.
Questions on the right side right now? Okay. We'll turn it over to the middle then. Please, right here.
Thank you. This is Céline Devranolo from the Alliance to Save Energy. You presented some numbers for R&D investment. I just wanted to ask what methodology you used to come up with those numbers, and is there any methodology to pick which technologies to invest in and how much? Thanks.
I'll start this answer, and then I'll ask Michael for some more. I mean, in general, we do have, there are studies that show, you would need to increase R&D spending by 10 times or whatever. We don't think there's any very, or we don't feel we have any very sound methodology in general for saying, this is the amount of R&D. And furthermore, in a way, we think it's the sort of wrong approach to say, increase your R&D. The question is what you need to spend it on, what you need to focus on. But we do, it's pretty clear to us that the trends of R&D spending now do not match the ambitions for a transformation of the energy sector. And we've also tried a slightly more bottom-up approach in the individual, we've still got one there.
Yep.
We have tried to estimate in a bit more detail for individual technologies what the R&D objectives are, and try to link that with what you might need. But we're a bit suspicious of sort of very general things. We're saying, it's got to be 10 times, or it's got to be,
Yeah, I just to reinforce really that this is not so much based on a needs analysis for the R&D requirement. We're basically looking at some of the technology hurdles and saying, what's the kind of investment needed in research and development, employment, taking quite a simple model of factoring in, an extra $500 million for each coal-fired power plant, et cetera. So we're looking, it's pretty basic, and as Neil said, I don't think we're very convinced that there's a strong link that would allow us to come up with numbers that are particularly easily quantifiable. So these are ballpark figures, trying to get an idea of where the share lies, perhaps not necessarily what the total should be. So looking at terms of where the focus of the effort should be, not the absolute level, because I think that's very highly uncertain.
Do you have a map of how, say, oil consumption will change by 2050? You have a snapshot of 2050, but do you have it modeled out year by year until then? You say it's going to decline, but would it peak in a particular year, et cetera?
Yeah, in this book there's not a lot on terms of the charts on the data for the intervening years. Generally, we've focused on 2015 and 2030 and 2050 to keep the presentation simple. But the models run on a five-year basis, to answer your question.
Hi, this is Prashant Joshi again from Selena Group. It's a quick, simple question. I mean, these are great roadmaps for the projections into 2050. Do you have a similar publication that goes into other countries, like not just the OECD countries, but breaking down into North America or places where there is no coal, or places where there's a lot of coal? The distributions would be different, correct? Do you have a publication?
Well, the roadmaps do attempt to look at that. You see I'm sorry they're not so legible. If you look at the first pie charts, those two pie charts, break down the potential for CO2 savings from the technology by not individual countries, but my... To be quite honest with you, we tend to be slightly coy about actual country projections. Even the U.S. is north appears as not... Well, it doesn't. It's not just the U.S., but you know, you can see we have North America. We don't actually have... So we do some attempt to break them down, but we don't know. We, generally speaking, we have not developed this study on individual country lines, and I think it's a question probably we'd have to review with our governing board and so on, whether one of the next things we do would be do more country-specific projections. And I don't know how we'll come out on that. That's more sensitive. We're going to a period where countries may be effectively negotiating on national targets, or some countries, we don't know, in the Bali process. So, but at the moment, we haven't done that, no.
I was going to ask you one, getting back to the transportation sector questions. There's a lot of discussion going on now here in Washington, a lot of focus on electric vehicles and plug-in electric vehicles. And the debate ranges from they're just around the corner and all we got to do is start going out and buying them to some saying it's likely to never come. Can you address a little bit what you see as the key challenges to bringing that technology to within range to be competitive against the current fuel systems?
Okay. It's an area that's evolving very rapidly, actually. The first thing I would say, though, is that the first thing you should do is simply improve the energy efficiency of the basic vehicle. So you need to have policies in place that mean the technological advances that we're likely to deploy in light-duty vehicles in the next 15 to 20 years are not used to increase power and weight, but are actually used to improve fuel economy. And we think they're in the range of 25 to 35% improvement. And, you know, 80% of that can be achieved at is likely to be achieved after the deployment at a negative cost. So that's the first thing you need to do, because that makes the proposition of moving to a hybrid, plug-in hybrid or a full electric vehicle a cheaper proposition. There's been significant improvement in battery technology in recent years, but I don't think it's still expensive. You know, you're looking at costs per kilowatt hour that are still, I would say, not prohibitive, but still make it an expensive abatement option. We're optimistic that those costs will continue to come down if we see the continued R&D effort. And if we continue to see the kind of improvements we have in recent years, then by 2020, 2030, that's going to be a relatively low cost. You know, plug-in hybrids are going to be a relatively low-cost abatement option. But there's a lot of work to do, and this question about how we get there and how quickly. So, I mean, in terms of deployment, it can happen soon, yes. But in terms of what it's going to cost in terms of marginal, you know, a marginal abatement, we think it's still going to be expensive in the short to medium term. But it's potentially, I mean, when you look at the decarbonisation of the power generation sector in the blue scenario, there's potentially certainly a synergy there that is going to be exploited.
I think we've got two more questions. Okay, two more questions, but quick ones.
Richard Wallace, no affiliation, but I used to work at the IEA. Could you turn the I heard $50 per ton. I heard $100 for transportation. $100 per ton, $200 per ton, and then I heard $500 per ton. Could you turn that into something that consumers understand, a gallon of gasoline or a vehicle per year or something like that? Thanks.
I'm going to have a go at this, and then Michael will tell me if I've got it right, or not. But I think two different. If you look at I'll do the talk about the power and then about the. In the power sector, you saw that chart which showed that we think, on an optimistic case, you can largely decarbonize the power sector with marginal costs of $50 per ton of CO2. Now, $50 per ton of CO2 for a coal power station of sort of average efficiency, and there's quite a big variation, turns into something like 3 or 4 cents per kilowatt hour, or $30 or $40 per megawatt hour, which, again, depending on the efficiency of the plant, could almost double your generating costs. So the base costs of your power generation could double for domestic consumers. Of course, a lot of the costs are transmission and distribution, so you're talking about increase of around a quarter on your, but for, of course, big industrial consumer, they would see pretty much directly the...
I pay 10 cents a kilowatt hour in the suburbs here. Okay,
well, that's... Okay, so they, so you are. So it's not necessarily, I mean, it's significant, but it's not, well, I don't know, you judge how, or how. I'm not going to, perhaps I shouldn't characterize that. I'm sure you wouldn't like to pay to have that on your electricity bill tomorrow, and a lot of other people wouldn't. A lot of other people wouldn't like that. Yeah. If you go on to vehicles, and there we're saying our optimistic case is $200 per ton of CO2, and that translates into the equivalent in terms of the cost to the motorist of about $80, an increment of $80 per barrel of crude oil. Okay, so, and when this was done, our projections were in the sort of $60 to $65 cost. So it would have, at that stage, it looked like what it would have taken actually to bring the total motoring cost up to something like today's actual price. Now, we're not projecting that today's price is going to continue forever, so that's a bit, that's misleading. But it's a big, yeah, it's a big increment. Thank you. Is that right? Sorry, I'm going to turn to Michael because he is. I'm practicing that.
Len Oberlander, very, very quickly. What is the correspondence between the reality on the ground in upgrading the electric powered grids and the resources to do that, the technology and so forth, with what you think is needed in your study? The Russian power grid is about to be started. The American power grid is outmoded, it's been said. So what is the correspondence here? Thanks.
I'll just say some general things. I don't know if Michael wants to add it, but I mean, yeah, I mean, that's a penetrating. That's well, I think most about 80% of my answer is that that's a rather penetrating question, because and sometimes you see. I think there are some players who don't necessarily see the connection between the transformation in power sources and the grid. And we had a conference where we said, if you love renewables, love your grid, because I think some people have the idea that renewables are somehow, local. Because renewables vary a lot, but if you're talking about the renewables that have variable output,
think about the Russian privatization, the power generating stations, what's happening with them, and then the grid is being renewed.
Well, you need, if you're going to transform your electricity supply, and don't forget we have 46% renewables in 2050. The way that you, or probably the most important way that you cope with the variability of renewables and the diverse sources and locations of your power is strengthening your grid. And it has to be said there's an opportunity here because just like the power plants, a lot of the grids in the US and in Europe need renewal, need modernizing. Not, you can be intelligent about whether you actually need to replace physical assets, but you certainly need to put more sophistication in than you need to, and you probably need to expand them to bring in, the wind potential that you've got and to balance the different parts of the thing. So, my answer is, good question. Not really. But is there anything to add? I don't know the answer. No.
Well, with that very good question, it's always good to leave on a question that needs to be dealt with in more depth in the future. Please join me in thanking Neil and Michael for this excellent presentation.